So I'm saying good evening again for those who might be listening later on who are missing this time. I am recording these and will post and posting them on the website. In a few minutes, we're going to have a chance to share something from our practice this past week with each other. But first, I want to say a little bit more about practicing with koans, because we're calling this retreat Life Koans for Precarious Times, something like that. I forget exactly what I'm calling it, something like that. And Life Koans, as I said last week, are the big questions that life hands us or throws at us or we trip over, all the different ways we encounter them. So last week we considered some of those life koans that came to us very early in life or in our youth, and then also in these past 3 months of sheltering in place, living in the time of COVID-19. And then weaving them in with the stories, the koans, the traditional stories from the Zen tradition. And not only the traditional ones from the classic anthologies, but the ones that through a great labor of love and have been gathered, the stories of women throughout Buddhist history and Zen history. Drawing mostly, but not entirely, on this book, which I'm sure some of you have. It's called The Hidden Lamp, Stories from 25 Centuries of Awakened Women, by our good friends, or edited by our good friends Florence Kaplow and Susan Moon. And it really was a labor of love for them to gather these stories and then to recruit 100 contemporary women teachers to provide commentaries on the 100 stories that they found. So yeah, I wanted to say a little bit more about practicing with koans. It's just too easy to reduce the question to a simple formula: Rinzai Zen does koan practice, Soto Zen doesn't. Rinzai and Soto are the two main sects. There's a smaller third one in Japan, which is our tradition. Our tradition is the Soto stream of Zen. I've heard a Rinzai teacher speak rather disparagingly of koan study versus koan practice. You know, we do koan practice, and koan study is an intellectual indulgence. Whereas koan practice is on the cushion. It's a method of meditative concentration designed to cut through our conventional, habitual, dualistic ways of thinking. A way to kind of induce a direct experience of awakening, of non-self, of non-duality. And in Japanese Rinzai Zen, the classic koan collections are organized into a kind of curriculum that the student works through in order, and presenting their understanding to the teacher on a regular basis, sometimes daily, sometimes more than daily. The teacher either rejects the response or accepts it, and then the student passes on to the next koan. Students are not supposed to discuss their koan practice or their answers with each other or to compare notes. But Rinzai teachers also teach what we think of as the basic Soto Zen practice of Shikantaza, which means just sitting. Just sitting with a spacious mind, attentive to the arising and passing of moment-to-moment experience. So even in Rinzai Zen, receiving a curriculum of having passed all the receiving a certificate of having passed all the koans in the curriculum is not a guarantee of enduring stable enlightenment. There's still a lifelong process of integrating that insight into every facet of one's life. So our Zen family, of Soto Zen, emphasizes a steady practice that's expressed not only in our Zazen practice, but in our everyday activities. Or in a monastery, it would be through in cooking, or ringing the bells, or cleaning, every aspect of monastic life. Over time, permeating everything that we do. Soto Zen doesn't use the koan curriculum, but Soto Zen texts, particularly those of Dogen, the Japanese monk who brought this practice from China to Japan in the 13th century, his texts are just full of references to koans. So the more acquainted we become with the koan literature, the more we see ways that it does connect to our practice in this tradition. But at the core of Dogen's teaching is what's called the Genjo Koan, which I like to translate as the fundamental koan of life. You could say that all koans can be distilled into it. In Dogen's famous words, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. When actualized by the myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. No trace of realization remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. That's from Dogen's text, Genjo Koan. So he uses the word, or the translation uses the word study here. But the Japanese verb is narau. And it's quite different from the verb that's used for academic study, which is benkyo suru. Narau is used for learning how to do something experientially. How to knit or bake bread, or build a table or a house. Or the way children learn language, as opposed to studying a language academically. That verb, narau, is very closely related to another verb, nareru, which means to become used to or to become intimate with. And this is the sense of study that Dogen is using. We are becoming intimately acquainted with the self, with our moment-to-moment experience directly. And the more closely we do this, the more we experience Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Zen teacher Thich Nhat Hanh, calls interbeing, the sort of interpenetration of self and the 10,000 things. When he says we forget the self, he means we forget our self-focus. And we are awakened by and with the 10,000 things. So it's a beautiful passage that I love very much. So I think when we approach the traditional koans and stories, which are a kind of Zen folk literature, really, you know, they were passed down orally before they were ever written down. And some of them are mythical, and some of them are based on historical characters, and some of them are no doubt embellished and embroidered. But when we approach these traditional old stories, I think we can be informed by and infused by this fundamental koan of the self in the world, self and other. So what we're going to be doing over these weeks together with koans is definitely unconventional, because we're going to discuss them together in community. we're going to express our response to them not only in words, but maybe in images or sound or movement. I'm really encouraging you to experiment with different mediums. Sometimes we even enact them, but that's a little hard on Zoom. So yes, this is unconventional. But most important, I think, is that we'll be raising up the koans in words or phrases or images in the course not only of our time in meditation, but in our daily lives, in our everyday activities. Just like the stories from last week of Chiyono, the young nun, fetching water from the well, or Patachara, putting out her oil lamp before going to bed, or Xiangyan, cutting grass. Ordinary everyday activities and moments of awakening. So we'll explore how these koans and stories of old resonate with our lived experience as women. And with the koans, the life koans that are presented to us in our living. And I think that this way of practicing with koans is quite congruent with our Zen practice as women living not in a monastery, but in the world, with families and jobs and responsibilities in the world. So, with that preamble, I would like to invite you to share your reflections from last week. I'm going to divide you into small groups. It's a bit of a trade-off. You know, I would love for us all to hear everyone's voices. And if I send you off into these Zoom breakout rooms, I don't get to hear any of you, any of your voices. But I think it's the only way for each person to get enough time to speak, because it would take a long time to go through everybody. Although at our last meeting we will make sure to hear, you know, from each person. So what I'm going to do is divide you into groups, and I'm glad. Did I see Stephanie make it back? Yeah, Stephanie's back. Good. What I'd like to do now is introduce some koans for the coming week. There's more to the story of Chiyono from last week. She was the young nun who went to gather water from the well, and the bottom dropped out, as you recall, and maybe you've been practicing with that koan of, you know, what happens when the bottom drops out. But that story, she's kind of a legendary character, and that story was probably grafted on at a later date. It chances are, I think, that it was, you know, some anonymous young nun, and it was a good story, and they decided, someone started telling it about a very famous nun named Mugai Nyodai, who was the very first nun in Japan to have full Dharma transmission as a Zen teacher, a Zen master in the Rinzai lineage in the 13th century. So her lifetime overlapped Dogen's lifetime. She was born a little bit later. And one reason it's the story is suspect is that she was actually born into quite a high-ranking family, and she married a feudal lord who was later exiled and then later killed. And like many women in those days, she didn't ordain until later in life. She was in her 50s after she'd been widowed that she entered monastic practice. So even if she did do some fetching of water and filling water buckets in her practice, she would have been quite an educated woman. She lived from 1223 to 1298, and during the early years of Zen in Japan. And the records indicate that she trained with an eminent Rinzai master, Enni Bennen, at Tofukuji Temple, which is the second Rinzai temple to be founded in Japan. We have gone there on our group trips to Japan. Anyone here? No one here has been on those trips with on our Sangha trips, but is somebody? I saw Michelle wave. Yeah, have you been to Tofukuji? Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful temple. Michael and Marley would have been, yeah, as well. It's a beautiful temple. Michael and I used to live a short walk away from it, and we went there often. So she founded a temple. I think that it's a little unclear from what I'm reading. I think in a different location, a temple which grew to include more than 15 sub-temples. But despite her achievements, her name nearly disappeared from the lineage records. The scholar Anne Dutton speculates that this was a deliberate effort of erasure by her Dharma nephew, who wanted to strengthen the concept of a singular lineage, because he was ordained by Mugai's Dharma brother. So even in modern times, images of Mugai were often assumed to be of a man. She wasn't recognized as a woman Zen master. So another story about her is that when she first approached Enni Bennen and asked to study with him, he was agreeable, but his monks raised objections. They didn't want to be distracted by the presence of a woman in their midst. Because she came from a well-to-do family, she offered to sponsor the building of a separate building for nuns on the premises. But the monks still objected. So she burned her face with a hot iron to demonstrate her sincerity and her non-attachment to her appearance as a woman, and was finally accepted. It's been speculated that the unevenness of her features in a famous statue of her may show the distortion caused by the scarring. I'm going to show you this picture. So, I'm going to expand it. Can you see that? Buddhist teachers, Zen masters, are often depicted sitting on chairs like that. The abbots would sit in chairs like that. And then in close-up, you can see her features, her left eye droops a little. I think it's a rather moving portrait. It seems a shocking extreme to go to us, but there are other examples in Chinese history. And then later in the 17th century, in 17th century Japan, of women literally defacing themselves. So here is a story from the Hidden Lamp Collection about a Japanese nun named Ryonen. As a young woman, Ryonen Genso was an attendant to the Empress and was known for her beauty and intelligence. When the Empress died, she felt the impermanence of life and she decided to become a nun. Ryonen traveled to the city of Edo in search of a Zen teacher. The first teacher refused her because of her beauty. Then she asked Master Hakuo Dotai, who also refused her. He could see her sincere intention, but he, too, said that her womanly appearance would cause problems for the monks in his monastery. Afterward, she saw some women pressing fabric, and she took a hot iron and held it against her face, scarring herself. Then she wrote this poem on the back of a small mirror. To serve my empress, I burned incense to perfume my exquisite clothes. Now, as a homeless mendicant, I burn my face to enter a Zen temple. The four seasons flow naturally like this. Who is this now in the midst of these changes? She returned to Hakuo and gave him the poem. He immediately accepted her as a disciple. She became abbess of his temple when he died and later founded her own temple. Before her death, she wrote this poem. This is the 66th autumn I have seen. The moon still lights my face. Don't ask me about the meaning of Zen teachings. Just listen to what the pines and cedars say on a windless night. So, women like Mugai and Nyonen are praised, and justly so, for their courage and their determination not to be deterred in their desire to practice. But there's something about the brutality of their acts that has never sat well with me. It's all too reminiscent of the many ways women have mutilated their bodies to gain the acceptance of men, whether through foot binding, waist cinching, or genital cutting. Not to mention the other ways we've effaced ourselves, made ourselves small, or docile, or silent. Wendy Egyoku Nakao, the abbot of Zen Center of Los Angeles, writes the reflection to this story. She asks, how do we find our voice in traditions that value silence and are bound by historical and cultural imperatives to ignore the voice of women? How do we women claim our sense of personal power and a healthy sense of self in traditions that confirm the truth of selflessness? How do we women affirm our bodies in traditions that emphasize abstaining from desire? Or I would even add revulsion towards the body, as some early Buddhist texts do. She continues, how do we find freedom within the forms that were born out of male domination? Good questions. There was no Me Too movement in medieval China and Japan. But women in Zen still found ways to resist harassment by men who were threatened by their strength and their clarity. So I'd like to share two more examples with you. First is from 12th century China. It's about Miaozong, who, like Mugai Nyodai, came from a prominent family of the educated class. This was often the case, that women in the early days of Zen came from well-to-do educated families. She had an early natural awakening in her teens and became interested in following the Buddhist path. But she was forbidden by her father to do so. She married an official, and as a result, she was able to travel, accompanying him, and to visit various famed Zen teachers and hear their teachings. One of them was Dahui, who was quite renowned, who gave her Dharma transmission when she was still a laywoman. She didn't ordain until she was 70, just 5 years before her death. But already she was renowned for her intelligence and her poetic abilities. So here's a story about her from The Hidden Lamp. that was only unearthed in the late 20th century by the scholar Miriam Levering. Before Miao Zong became a nun, she used to visit Master Dahui. Dahui's monastery to study with him, and he gave her a room in the abbot's quarters. The senior monk, Wan Nan, did not approve. Dahui said to him, "Although she's a woman, she has outstanding merits." Wan Nan still disapproved, so Dahui urged him to have an interview with Miao Zong. Wan Nan reluctantly agreed and requested an interview. Miao Zong said, "Do you want a Dharma interview or a worldly interview?" "A Dharma interview," replied Wan Nan. Miao Zong said, "Then send your attendants away." She went into the room first, and after a few moments she called, "Please come in." When Wan Nan entered, he saw Miao Zong lying naked on her back on the bed. He pointed at her genitals, saying, "What is this place?" Miao Zong replied, "Oh dear. Give me a minute, because there's a line missing and it's an important line. Give me a sec." "May I ask your patience while I retrieve this important line?"
It's page 107, if that helps.
Oh, thank you. Yes, here's the important line. Okay, coming back to the screen. She replied, he asked, "What is this place?" Miao Zong replied, "All the Buddhas of the three worlds, the six patriarchs, and all great monks everywhere came out of this place." Wan Nan said, "And may I enter?" Miao Zong replied, "Horses may cross, asses may not." Wan Nan was unable to reply. Miao Zong declared, "I have met you, senior monk. The interview is over." She turned her back to him. Wan Nan left ashamed. Later, Dahui said to him, "The old dragon has some wisdom, doesn't she?" Quite a story. I've always felt a little dubious about this story. Although it certainly shows Miao Zong's fierce and daring intelligence, I have wondered, was this story retained and passed down by male Zen monks in part for its titillation value? Had it been embellished in the telling? Did she really strip down to make her point? Whatever the case, she made her point well. All the Buddhas of the three worlds, the six patriarchs, and all great monks everywhere came out of this place. "May I enter?" he asks, pushing his luck. "Horses may cross, asses may not." End of interview. Miao Zong is playing on a famous koan from the classic collection, the Blue Cliff Record, case 52. A monk asked Jiaozhou, "For a long time I've heard of the stone bridge of Jiaozhou, but now that I've come here, I just see a simple log bridge. So I've heard you're this great Zen master, but I see you and you just, you know, a simple old guy." Jiaozhou said, "You see the log bridge, you don't see the stone bridge." The monk said, "What is the stone bridge?" Jiaozhou said, "It lets asses cross, it lets horses cross." So Jiaozhou is challenging this arrogant young monk to go beyond his dualistic evaluations. Stone bridge, log bridge, horses, asses. Two sides to the same coin. Miaozong, though, is challenging this arrogant senior monk to recognize and respect difference. So we've got the perspective of no difference, unity, and the perspective of differentiation, the relative and the absolute, the two truths. Okay, one more story. And this one is about the 17th century Chinese nun, Ziyong, who was said to be the second coming of Miaozong, the one I just talked about. Several centuries later. She was renowned as a teacher. She traveled widely on pilgrimage, teaching and founding places of practice and writing about her travels. And like her ancestor, Miaozong, she rises to meet a challenge. A scholar traveled a long distance to meet with Master Ziyong Chengru. He entered the hall, and he and Ziyong looked at each other. Then the scholar said, "I've come to visit this ship of compassion, but who would have guessed that the ship of compassion would turn out to be nothing but an old crone?" Ziyong gave an earth-shaking roar. "What is this place? Tell me, is it male or is it female?" When the scholar could not reply, she said to him, "Come closer and I'll tell you." When the scholar was right in front of her, she grabbed him and said, "From the day you left Spirit Mountain, there has been no place to seek. From this day on, mother and son are reunited." The scholar said, "I trust you completely," and bowing to Ziyong, requested ordination from her. So here she is at the height of her power, giving a lion's earth-shaking roar. That's what the trope for the Buddha's teaching is, the lion's roar, right? "What is this place? Tell me, is it male or is it female? Time to let go of all our conditioning, our stereotypes, our labels, our hindrances. This path of liberation is for all of us, if we're willing to be scrupulous in our self-awareness and inquiry." Daijaku Judith Kinst, who writes the commentary on this story, she's a priest from our San Francisco Zen Center lineage who teaches in Santa Cruz, asks us, "What strength can we depend on when we step close and encounter what is most true about ourselves and all beings? The earth-shaking roar of Ziyong is in our bones, and this is the strength that animates our days and clarifies our lives. This is what we depend on." So what do you depend on when you face a challenge, when someone demeans or dismisses you, when someone expects or demands that you efface or silence yourself? And these imperatives come not only from men. Women can demean and dismiss other women and girls too, internalizing those received judgments and projecting them outward. What do you depend on? Where do you draw your strength to take your place in the world and offer who you are, just as you are? This is what our bodhisattva vows ask of us. How do we find the strength? Well, I'm going to ask you to just take a few minutes and just jot down some notes for yourself. You know, don't try and write an essay. Just jot down some phrases and notes that come to you in answer to those questions I just asked. What do you depend on? What gives you the strength? When you're feeling that someone has demeaned or dismissed you or silenced you or effaced you. Or when you've done that to yourself, may I also add, because we do internalize those messages. What do you depend on? Where do you find the strength? Okay, so thank you, everyone, for jumping in and being willing to share your reflections with each other. I will send you these stories. Everybody doing okay with those Word documents? Do I need to send PDFs? Let me know if you have any trouble receiving what I send. I will send these out to you. And again, I really encourage you to just see what word or phrase or image really stands out for you, and take that as your koan. You know, as you're sitting in your zazen, either for a designated period or part of a period. Just raise that word or phrase or image up in your mind with a sense of inquiry, of openness, not trying to figure anything out, just a receptivity. And then through your day, it may just come to you, or pause and open to that sense of inquiry. And then express your response in some way. You know, write something down, or draw something, or paint something, or sing something, and experiment a little and see what comes, okay? The editors of the Hidden Lamp Collection, Sue Moon and Florence Kaplo, at the end of each section, as you probably see, they give you some reflection questions. And the ones that they give for that last story about Ziyong and the scholar coming to challenge her. And then this beautiful scene where the scholar says, "I trust you completely. I get it." Their reflection questions are, let me just read them. Is it necessary to leave home in search of the truth in order to learn that you don't have to leave home to search for the truth? Can mother and son be reunited inside your own heart? Who is the mother in you and who is the son? I would be interested to see how we might rejig those questions, or even the story itself, to look at the mother-daughter connection. There are, in all these stories, it's very rare to have an exchange between a Dharma mother and daughter. And so it'd be interesting, how would you rewrite that story, or how would you answer that question? How can mother and daughter be reunited in your own heart? Who is the mother in you and who is the daughter? Or son, play around. You might want to play around with those. And that will be a kind of segue into next week's stories, which have to do with what is the quest, what is the home-leaving quest for in women's lives for you. Okay, that concludes our evening. Let's chant the refuges together to close.